running after Usher and Bran, and there was nothing Maester Luwin could do but follow, keeping a wary eye on the walls. Maester Luwin's turret was so cluttered that it seemed to Bran a wonder that he ever found anything. Tottering piles of books, covered tables and chairs, rows of stoppered jars lined the shelves, candle stubs and puddles of dried wax dotted the furniture. The bronze Moorish lens tube sat on a tripod by the terrace door. Star charts hung from the walls. Shadow maps lay scattered among the rushes. Papers, quills, and pots of ink were everywhere, and all of it was spotted with droppings from the ravens in the rafters. Their strident quawks drifted down from above as Usher washed and cleaned and bandaged the maester's wounds, under Luwin's terse instruction.
"This is folly," the small grey man said, while she dabbed at the wolf's bites with a stinging ointment. "I agree that it is odd that both you boys dreamed the same dream, yet when you stop to consider it, it's only natural. You miss your Lord Father, and you know that he is a captive. Fear can fever a man's mind and give him queer thoughts. Rickon is too young to comprehend." "I'm 4 now," Rickon said.
He was peering through the lens tube at the gargoyles on the first keep. The direwolves sat on opposite sides of the large round room, licking their wounds and gnawing on bones.
"Too young, and oh, 7 hells, that burns. No, no, don't stop. More. Too young, as I say, but you, Bran, you're old enough to know that dreams are only dreams."
"Some are, some aren't."
Usher poured pale red fire milk into a long gash. Luwin gasped.
"The children of the forest could tell you a thing or two about dreaming."
Tears were streaming down the maester's face, yet he shook his head doggedly.
"The children live only in dreams. Now, dead and gone. Enough, that's enough. Now the bandages. Pads, and then wrap. And make it tight. I'll be bleeding."
Old Nan says the children knew the songs of the trees, that they could fly like birds and swim like fish and talk to the animals, Bran said. She says that they made music so beautiful that it made you cry like a little baby just to hear it.
"And all this they did with magic," Maester Luwin said, distracted. "I wish they were here now. A spell would heal my arm less painfully, and they could talk to Shaggy Dog and tell him not to bite."
He gave the big black wolf an angry glance out of the corner of his eye.
"Take a lesson, Bran. The man who trusts in spells is dueling with a glass sword, as the children did. Here, let me show you something."
He stood abruptly across the room and returned with a green jar in his good hand.
"Have a look at these," he said, as he pulled the stopper and shook out a handful of shiny black arrowheads.
Bran picked one up.
"It's made of glass."
Curious, Rickon drifted closer to peer over the table.
"Dragon glass,"
Usher named it, as she sat down beside Luwin, bandagings in hand.
"Obsidian,"
Maester Luwin insisted, holding out his wounded arm.
"Forged in the fires of the gods far below the earth. The children of the forest hunted with that thousands of years ago. The children worked no metal. In place of mail, they wore long shirts of woven leaves and bound their legs in bark, so that they seemed to melt into the wood. In place of swords, they carried blades of obsidian. And still do."
Usher placed soft pads over the bites on the maester's forearm and bound them tight with long strips of linen. Bran held the arrowhead up close. The black glass was slick and shiny. He thought it beautiful.
"Can I keep one?"
"As you wish," the maester said. "I want one too," Rickon said. "I want 4. I'm 4.
Luwin made him count them out.
"Be careful. They're still sharp. Don't cut yourself."
"Tell me about the children," Bran said. It was important.
"What do you wish to know?"
"Everything."
Maester Luwin tugged his chain collar where it chafed against his neck.
"They were the people of the Dawn Age. the very first, before kings and kingdoms, he said. In those days there were no castles or holdfasts, no cities, not so much as a market town to be found between here and the Sea of Dawn. There were no men at all. Only the children of the forest dwelt in the lands we now call the Seven Kingdoms. There were a people, dark and beautiful, small of stature, no taller than children, even when grown to manhood. They lived in the depths of the wood, in caves and crannogs and secret tree towns. Slight as they were, the children were quick and graceful. Male and female hunted together, with weirwood bows and flying snares. Their gods were the gods of the forest, stream, and stone, the old gods, whose names are secret. Their wise men were called green seers, and carved strange faces in the weirwoods to keep watch on the woods. How long the children reigned here, or where they came from, no man can know. But some 12,000 years ago, the first men appeared from the east, crossing the broken arm of Dawn before it was broken. They came with bronze swords and great leather shields, riding horses. No horse had ever been seen on this side of the narrow sea. No doubt the children were as frightened by the horses as the first men were by the faces in the trees. As the first men carved out holdfasts and farms, they cut down the faces and gave them to the fire. Horror-struck, the children went to war. The old songs say that the green seers used dark magics to make the sea rise and sweep away the land, shattering the arm. But it was too late to close the door. The wars went on, until the earth ran red with blood of men and children both, but more children than men, for men were bigger and stronger, and wood and stone and obsidian make a poor match for bronze. Finally, the wise of both races prevailed, and the chiefs and heroes of the first men met the green seers and wood dancers amidst the weirwood groves of a small island in the great lake called God's Eye. There they forged the pact. The first men were given the coastlands, the high plains and bright meadows, the mountains and bogs, but the deep woods were to remain forever the children's, and no more weirwoods were to be put to the axe anywhere in the realm. So the gods might bear witness to the signing, every tree on the island was given a face. And afterward, the sacred order of green men was formed to keep watch over the Isle of Faces. The pact began 4,000 years of friendship between men and children. In time, the first men even put aside the gods they had brought with them and took up the worship of the secret gods of the wood. The signing of the pact ended the Dawn Age and began the Age of Heroes. Bran's fist curled around the shiny black arrowhead. "But the children of the forest are all gone now," you said.
"Here they are,"
said Osha, as she bit off the end of the last bandage with her teeth.
"North of the wall, things are different. That's where the children went, and the giants, and the other old races."
Maester Lewin sighed. "A woman, by rights, you ought to be dead or in chains. The Starks have treated you more gently than you deserve. It is unkind to repay them for their kindness by filling the boys' heads with folly."
"Tell me where they went," Bran said. "I want to know."
"Me too,"
Rickon echoed.
"Oh, very well," Lewin muttered. "So long as the kingdoms of the first men held sway, the pact endured. All through the Age of Heroes and the Long Night and the birth of the Seven Kingdoms. Yet finally there came a time, many centuries later, when other peoples crossed the Narrow Sea. The Andals were the first,
a race of tall, fair-haired warriors who came with steel and fire and the seven-pointed star of the new gods painted on their chests. The wars lasted hundreds of years, but in the end, the six southern kingdoms all fell before them. Only here, where the king of the north threw back every army that tried to cross the neck, did the rule of the first men endure. The Andals burnt out the weirwood groves, hacked down the faces, slaughtered the children where they found them, and everywhere proclaimed the triumph of the seven over the old gods. So the children fled north. Summer began to howl. Maester Lewin broke off, startled. When Shaggy Dog bounded to his feet and added his voice to his brother's, dread clutched at Bran's heart.
"It's coming,"
he whispered, with a certainty of despair. He had known it since last night, he realized, since the crow had led him down into the crypts to say farewell. He had known it, but he had not believed. He had wanted Maester Lewin to be right.
"The crow," he thought, "the three-eyed crow."
The howling stopped as suddenly as it had begun. Summer padded across the tower floor to Shaggy Dog and began to lick at a mat of bloody fur on the back of his brother's neck. From the window came a flutter of wings. A raven landed on the grey stone sill, opened its beak, and gave a harsh, raucous rattle of distress. Rickon began to cry. His arrowheads fell from his hand one by one and clattered on the floor. Bran pulled him close and hugged him. Maester Lewin stared at the black bird, as if it were a scorpion with feathers. He rose, slow as a sleepwalker, and moved to the window. When he whistled, the raven hopped onto his bandaged forearm. There was dried blood on its wings.
"A hawk," Lewin muttered. "Perhaps an owl. Oh, poor thing. I wonder it got through."
He took the letter from its leg. Bran found himself shivering as the maester unrolled the paper. "What is it?" he said, holding his brother all the harder.
"You know what it is, boy,"
Usher said, not unkindly. She put her hand on his head. Maester Lewin looked up at them, numbly. A small, grey man, with blood on the sleeve of his grey wool robe and tears in his bright grey eyes.
"My lords," he said to the sons, in a voice gone hoarse and shrunken, we shall need to find a stone carver who knew his likeness well."
Theon. Maester Lewin came to him when the first scouts were seen outside the walls.
"My lord prince," he said, "you must yield."
Theon stared at the platter of oat cakes, honey, and blood sausage they'd brought him to break his fast. Another sleepless night had left his nerves raw, and the very sight of food sickened him.
"There has been no reply from my uncle?"
"None," the maester said.
"Nor from your father, Unpike. Send more birds." "It will not serve. By the time each bird reach, send them."
Knocking the platter of food aside with a swipe of his arm, he pushed off the blankets and rose from Ned Stark's bed, naked and angry.
"Or do you want me dead? Is that it, Lewin? The truth now?"
The small grey man was unafraid.
"My order serves."
"Yes, but whom?"
"The realm," Maester Lewin said, "and Winterfell. Theon, once I taught you sums and letters, history and warcraft, and might have taught you more had you wished to learn. I will not claim to bear you any great love, no, but I cannot hate you either. Even if I did, as long as you hold Winterfell, I am bound by oath to give you counsel.
So now I counsel you to yield." Theon stooped to scoop a puddled cloak off the floor, shook off the rushes, and draped it over his shoulders. "A fire. I'll have a fire. And clean garb. Where's Wex? I'll not go to my grave in dirty clothes."
"You have no hope of holding here," the maester went on. "If your lord father meant to send you aid, he would have done so by now. It is the neck that concerns him. The battle for the north will be fought amidst the ruins of Moat Cailin."
"That may be so," said Theon. "And so long as I hold Winterfell, Sir Roderick and Stark's lord's bannermen cannot march south to take my uncle in the rear." "I'm not so innocent a warcraft as you think, old man. I have food enough to stand a year's siege if need be."
"There will be no siege. Perhaps they will spend a day or two fashioning ladders and tying grapnels to the ends of ropes, but soon enough they will come over your walls in 100 places at once. You may be able to hold the keep for a time, but the castle will fall within the hour. You would do better to open your gates and ask for
mercy." "I know what kind of mercy they'll have for me."
"There is a way."
"I am ironborn," Theon reminded him. "I have my own way. What choice have they left me? No, don't answer. I've heard enough of your counsel. Go and send those birds as I commanded, and tell Loren I want to see him, and Wex as well. I'll have my mail scoured clean and my garrison assembled in the yard." For a moment he thought the maester was going to defy him, but finally Lewin bowed stiffly.
"As you command."
They made a pitifully small assembly. The iron men were few, the yard large. "The Northmen will be on us before nightfall," he told them. "Sir Roderick Cassel and all the lords who have come to his call. I will not run from them. I took this castle, and I mean to hold it, to live or die as Prince of Winterfell. But I will not command any man to die with me. If you leave now, before Sir Roderick's main force is upon us, there's still a chance you may win free." He unsheathed his longsword and drew a line in the dirt. "Those who would stay and fight, step forward." No one spoke. The men stood in their mail and fur and boiled leather, as still as if they were made of stone. A few exchanged looks. Erzan shuffled his feet. Dick Harlaw hawked and spat. A finger of wind ruffled Endahar's long fair hair. Theon felt as though he were drowning. "Why am I surprised?" he thought bleakly. His father had forsaken him, his uncles, his sister, even that wretched creature Reek. Why should his men prove any more loyal? There was nothing to say, nothing to do. He could only stand there beneath the great grey walls and the hard white sky, sword in hand, waiting, waiting. Wex was the first to cross the line. 3 quick steps, and he stood at Theon's side, slouching. Shamed by the boy, Black Loren followed, all scowls. "Who else?" he demanded. Red Rolf came forward. Crumb, Werleg, Timorn his brothers, Ulf the Ill, Harag, Sheepstealer, 4 Harlaws, and 2 Butleys. Kenard the Whale was the last. 17 in all. Erzan was among those who did not move, and Stig, and every man of the 10 that Asher had brought from Deepwood Mutt. "Go then," Theon told them. "Run to my sister. She'll give you all a warm welcome, I have no doubt." Stig had the grace at least to look ashamed. The rest moved off without a word. Theon turned to the 17 who remained. "Back to the walls. If the gods should spare us, I shall remember every man of you." Black Loren stayed when the others had gone. "The castle folk will turn on us soon as the fight begins." "I know that. What would you have me do?" "Put them out," said Loren. "Every one." Theon shook his head. "Is the noose ready?" "It is. You mean to use it?" "Do you know a better way?" "Aye. I'll take my axe and stand on that drawbridge and let them come try me. One at a time, two, three. It makes no matter. None will pass the moat while I still draw breath.
He means to die, thought Theon. It's not victory he wants, it's an end worthy of a song.
We'll use the noose. As you say, Loren replied, contempt in his eyes. Wex helped garb him for battle. Beneath his black surcoat and golden mantle was a shirt of well-oiled ringmail, and under that a layer of stiff boiled leather. Once armed and armoured, Theon climbed the watchtower, at the angle where the eastern and southern walls come together, to have a look at his doom. The Northmen were spreading out to encircle the castle. It was hard to judge their numbers. 1,000 at least, perhaps, twice that many. Against 17? They'd brought catapults and scorpions. He saw no siege towers rumbling up the King's Road, but there was timber enough in the Wolfswood to build as many as were required. Theon studied their banners through Maester Lewin's Mirish lens tube. The Serwyn battle axe flapped bravely wherever he looked, and there were tall out trees as well, and mermen from White Harbour. Less common were the sigils of Flint and Karstark. Here and there he even saw the bull moose of the Hornwoods. But no Glovers. Asher saw to them. No Boltons from the Dreadfort. No Umbers come down from the shadow of the wall. Not that they were needed. Soon enough the boy, Clay Serwyn, appeared before the gates, carrying a peace banner and a tall staff, to announce that Sir Roderick Cassel wished to parley with Theon Turncloak. Turncloak?
The name was bitter as bile. He had gone to Pike to lead his father's longships against Lannisport, he remembered.
I shall be out shortly, he shouted down. Alone!
Black Loren disapproved.
Only blood can wash out blood, he declared. Knights may keep their truces with other knights, but they are not so careful of their honour when dealing with those they deem outlaw.
Theon bristled.
I am the Prince of Winterfell, an heir to the Iron Islands. Now go find the girl and do as I told you.
Black Loren gave him a murderous look.
Aye, Prince.
He's turned against me too, Theon realized. Of late it seemed to him as if the very stones of Winterfell had turned against him. If I die friendless and abandoned. What choice did that leave him but to live? He rode to the gatehouse with his crown on his head. A woman was drawing water from the well, and Gage the cook stood in the doorway of the kitchens. They hid their hatred behind sullen looks and faces blank as slate, yet he could feel it all the same. When the drawbridge was lowered, a chill wind sighed across the moat. The touch of it made him shiver.
It is a cold, nothing more,
Theon told himself. A shiver, not a tremble. Even brave men shiver. Into the teeth of that wind he rode, under the portcullis, over the drawbridge. The outer gates swung open to let him pass. As he emerged beneath the walls, he could sense the boys watching from the empty sockets where their eyes had been. Sir Roderick waited in the market astride his dappled gelding. Beside him, the direwolf of Stark flapped from a staff borne by young Clay Serwyn. They were alone in the square, though Theon could see archers on the roofs of surrounding houses, spearmen to his right, and to his left a line of mounted knights beneath the merman and trident of House Manderley.
Every one of them wants me dead.
Some were boys he'd drunk with, diced with, even wenched with, but that would not save him if he fell into their hands.
Sir Roderick, Theon reined to a halt. It grieves me that we must meet as foes.
My own grief is that I must wait a while to hang you.
The old knight spat onto the muddy ground.
Theon Turncloak.
I am a Greyjoy of Pike, Theon reminded him. The cloak my father swaddled me in bore a kraken, not a direwolf.
For 10 years you have been a ward of Stark.
Hostage and prisoner, I call it.
Then perhaps Lord Edward should have kept you chained to a dungeon wall. Instead, he raised you amongst his own sons, the sweet boys you have butchered. And to my undying shame, I trained you in the arts of war. Would that I had thrust a sword through your belly instead of placing one in your hand. I came out to parley, not to suffer your insults. Say what you have to say, old man. What would you have of me?
Two things, the old man said. Winterfell and your life. Command your men to open the gates and lay down their arms. Those who murdered no children shall be free to walk away, but you shall be held for King Rob's justice. May the gods take pity on you when he returns.
Rob will never look on Winterfell again, Theon promised. He will break himself on Moat Cailin, as every southern army has done for 10,000 years. We hold the north now, sir.
You hold 3 castles, replied Sir Roderick. And this one I mean to take back, Turncloak.
Theon ignored that.
Here are my terms. You have until evenfall to disperse. Those who swear fealty to Balon Greyjoy as their king and to myself as Prince of Winterfell will be confirmed in their rights and properties and suffer no harm. Those who defy us will be destroyed.
Young Cerwyn was incredulous.
Are you mad, Greyjoy?
Sir Roderick shook his head.
Only vain, lad. Theon has always had too lofty an opinion of himself, I fear.
The old man jabbed a finger at him.
Do not imagine that I need to wait for Rob to fight his way up the neck to deal with the likes of you. I have near 2,000 men with me, and if the tales be true, you have no more than 50.
17, in truth. Theon made himself smile. I have something better than men. And he raised a fist over his head, the signal Black Lauren had been told to watch for. The walls of Winterfell were behind him, but Sir Roderick faced them squarely and could not fail to see. Theon watched his face. When his chin quivered under those stiff white whiskers, he knew just what the old man was seeing.
He's not surprised, he thought with sadness. But the fear is there.
This is Craven, Sir Roderick said. To use a child, so this is despicable.
Oh, I know, said Theon. It's a dish I tasted myself, or have you forgotten? I was 10 when I was taken from my father's house to make certain he would raise no more rebellions.
It is not the same.
Theon's face was impassive.
The noose I wore was not made of hempen rope, that's true enough, but I felt it all the same. And it chafed, Sir Roderick, it chafed me raw.
He'd never quite realized that until now, but as the words came spilling out, he saw the truth of them.
And no harm was ever done you.
And no harm will be done your Beth, so long as you...
Sir Roderick never gave him the chance to finish.
Viper,
the knight declared, his face red with rage beneath those white whiskers.
I gave you the chance to save your men and die with some small shred of honour, Turncloak. I should have known that was too much to ask of a child-killer.
His hand went to the hilt of his sword.
I ought to cut you down, here and now, and put an end to your lies and deceits. By the gods, I should.
Theon did not fear a doddering old man, but those watching archers and that line of knights were a different matter. If the sword came out, his chances of getting back to the castle alive were small to none.
Forswear your oath and murder me, and you will watch your little Beth strangle at the end of a rope.
Sir Roderick's knuckles had gone white, but after a moment he took his hand off his sword hilt.
Truly, I have lived too long. I will not disagree, sir. Will you accept my terms? I have a duty to Lady Catelyn and House Stark. And your own house. Beth is the last of your blood.
The old knight drew himself up straight.
I offer myself in my daughter's place. Release her and take me as your hostage.
Surely the Castellan of Winterfell is worth more than a child.
Not to me.
A valiant gesture, old man, but I am not that great a fool. Nor to Lord Manderley or Leobold Tallheart either, I'll wager. Your sorry old skin is worth no more to them than any other man's. No, I'll keep the girl, and keep her safe, so long as you do as I've commanded you. Her life is in your hands.
Gods be good, Theon. How can you do this? You know I must attack, have sworn, if this host is still in arms before my gate when the sun sets, Beth will hang, said Theon. Another hostage will follow her to the grave at first light, and another at sunset. Every dawn and every dusk will mean a death, until you are gone. I have no lack of hostages.
He did not wait for a reply, but wheeled Smiler around and rode back toward the castle. He went slowly at first, but the thought of those archers at his back soon drove him to a canter. The small heads watched him come from their spikes, their tarred and flayed faces looming larger with every yard. Between them stood little Beth Cassell, noosed and crying. Theon put his heel into Smiler and broke into a hard gallop. Smiler's hooves clattered on the drawbridge like drumbeats. In the yard he dismounted and handed the reins to Wex. "It may stay them," he told Black Lauren. "We'll know by sunset. Take the girl in till then, and keep her somewhere safe." Under the layers of leather, steel, and wool, he was slick with sweat. "I need a cup of wine. A vat of wine would do even better." A fire had been laid in Ned Stark's bedchamber. Theon sat beside it and filled a cup with heavy-bodied red from the castle vaults, a wine as sour as his mood. "They will attack," he thought gloomily, staring at the flames. "Sir Roderick loves his daughter, but he is still Castellan, and, most of all, a knight." Had it been Theon with a noose around his neck, and Lord Balon commanding the army without, the war horns would already have sounded the attack, he had no doubt. He should thank the gods that Sir Roderick was not iron-born. The men of the Greenlands were made of softer stuff, though he was not certain they would prove soft enough. If not, if the old man gave the command to storm the castle regardless, Winterfell would fall. Theon entertained no delusions on that count. His 17 might kill 3, 4, 5 times their own number, but in the end they would be overwhelmed. Theon stared at the flames over the rim of his wine goblet, brooding on the injustice of it all. "I rode beside Robb Stark, in the Whispering Wood," he muttered. He had been frightened that night, but not like this. It was one thing to go into battle surrounded by friends, and another to perish alone and despised. "Mercy," he thought miserably. When the wine brought no solace, Theon sent Wex to fetch his bow and took himself to the old inner ward. There he stood, loosing shaft after shaft at the archery butts until his shoulders ached and his fingers were bloody, pausing only long enough to pull the arrows from the targets for another round. "I saved Bran's life with this bow," he reminded himself. "Would that I could save my own." Women came to the well, but did not linger. Whatever they saw on Theon's face sent them away quickly. Behind him the broken tower stood, its summit as jagged as a crown, where fire had collapsed the upper stories long ago. As the sun moved, the shadow of the tower moved as well, gradually lengthening, a black arm reaching out for Theon Greyjoy. By the time the sun touched the wall, he was in its grasp. "If I hang the girl, the Northmen will attack at once," he thought as he loosed a shaft. "If I do not hang her, they will know my threats are empty." He knocked another arrow to his bow. "There is no way out, none." "If you had 100 archers as good as yourself, you might have a chance to hold the castle," a voice said softly. When he turned,
Maester Lewin was behind him. "Go away," Theon told him. "I've had enough of your counsel."
"And life? Have you had enough of that, my lord prince?"
He raised the bow. "One more word, and I'll put this shaft through your heart."
"You won't."
Theon bent the bow, drawing the grey goose feathers back to his cheek. "Care to make a wager?"
"I am your last hope, Theon."
"I have no hope," he thought. Yet he lowered the bow half an inch and said, "I will not run.
I do not speak of running. Take the black."
"The night's watch?" Theon let the bow unbend slowly and pointed the arrow at the ground.
"Sir Roderick has served House Stark all his life, and House Stark has always been a friend to the watch. He will not deny you. Open your gates, lay down your arms, accept his terms, and he must let you take the black."
"A brother of the Night's Watch?" It meant no crown, no sons, no wife, but it meant life, and life with honour. Ned Stark's own brother had chosen the watch, and Jon Snow as well. "I have black garb aplenty once I tear the krakens off. Even my horse is black. I could rise high in the watch. A chief of rangers, likely even Lord Commander. Let Asha keep the bloody islands. They're as dreary as she is. If I served at Eastwatch, I could command my own ship. And there's fine hunting beyond the wall. As for women, what wildling woman wouldn't want a prince in her bed?"
A slow smile crept across his face.
"A black cloak can't be turned. I'd be as good as any man."
"Prince Theon!"
The sudden shout shattered his daydream. Crumb was loping across the yard.
"The Northman!"
He felt a sudden sick sense of dread.
"Is it the attack?"
Maester Lewin clutched his arm.
"There's still time. Raise a peace banner."
"They're fighting," Crumb said urgently. "More men came up, hundreds of them, and at first they made to join the others, but now they've fallen on them."
"Is it Asha?"
Had she come to save him after all? But Crumb gave a shake of his head.
"No, these are Northmen, I tell you, with a bloody man on their banner."
"The flayed man of the Dreadfort." Reek had belonged to the bastard of Bolton before his capture, Theon recalled. It was hard to believe that a vile creature like him could sway the Boltons to change their allegiance, but nothing else made sense.
"I'll see this for myself," Theon said.
Maester Lewin trailed after him. By the time they reached the battlements, dead men and dying horses were strewn about the market square outside the gates. He saw no battle lines, only a swirling chaos of banners and blades. Shouts and screams rang through the cold autumn air. Sir Roderick seemed to have the numbers, but the Dreadfort men were better led and had taken the others unawares. Theon watched them charge and wheel and charge again, chopping the larger force to bloody pieces every time they tried to form up between the houses. He could hear the crash of iron axe heads on oaken shields over the terrified trumpeting of a maimed horse. The inn was burning, he saw. Black Lauren appeared beside him and stood silently for a time. The sun was low in the west, painting the fields and houses all a glowing red. A thin, wavering cry of pain drifted over the walls, and a war horn sounded off beyond the burning houses. Theon watched a wounded man drag himself painfully across the ground, smearing his life's blood in the dirt as he struggled to reach the well that stood at the centre of the market square. He died before he got there. He wore a leather jerkin and a conical half-helm, but no badge to tell which side he'd fought on. The crows came in the blue dust with the evening stars. "The Dothraki believe the stars are spirits of the valiant dead," Theon said. Maester Lewin had told him that a long time ago.
"Dothraki?"
"The horse lords across the narrow seas."
"Oh, them."
Black Lauren frowned through his beard.
"Savages believe all manner of foolish things."
As the night grew darker and the smoke spread, it was harder to make out what was happening below. But the din of steel gradually diminished to nothing, and the shouts and war horns gave way to moans and piteous wailing. Finally, a column of mounted men rode out of the drifting smoke. At their head was a knight in dark armour. His rounded helm gleamed a sullen red, and a pale pink cloak streamed from his shoulders. Outside the main gate, he reined up, and one of his men shouted for the castle to open. "Are you friend or foe?" Black Lauren bellowed down.
"Would a foe bring such fine gifts?"
Red Helm waved a hand, and three corpses were dumped in front of the gates. A torch was waved above the bodies, so the defenders upon the walls might see the faces of the dead.
"The old Castellan," said Black Lauren. "With Leopold Tallheart and Clay Serwyn."
The boy lord had taken an arrow in the eye, and Sir Roderick had lost his left arm at the elbow. Maester Lewin gave a wordless cry of dismay, turned away from the battlements, and fell to his knees, sick.
"The great big Manderley was too craven to leave White Harbour, or we would have brought him as well," shouted Red Helm.
"I am saved," Theon thought. So why did he feel so empty? This was victory. Sweet victory, the deliverance he had prayed for. He glanced at Maester Lewin. "To think how close I came to yielding and taking the black."
"Open the gates for our friends."
Perhaps tonight Theon would sleep without fear of what his dreams might bring. The Dreadfort men made their way across the moat and through the inner gates. Theon descended with Black Lauren and Maester Lewin to meet them in the yard. Pale red pennons trailed from the ends of a few lances, but many more carried battle axes and great swords and shields hacked half to splinters.
"How many men did you lose?"
Theon asked Red Helm as he dismounted.
20 or 30.
The torchlight glittered off the chipped enamel of his visor. His helm and gorget were wrought in the shape of a man's face and shoulders, skinless and bloody, mouth open in a silent howl of anguish.
"Sir Roderick, had you 5 to 1? "Aye, but he thought us friends. A common mistake. When the old fool gave me his hand, I took half his arm instead. Then I let him see my face."
The man put both hands to his helm and lifted it off his head, holding it in the crook of his arm.
"Reek!"
Theon said, disquieted. "How did a serving man get such fine armour?" The man laughed.
"The wretch is dead." He stepped closer. "The girl's fault. If she had not run so far, his horse would not have lamed, and we might have been able to flee. I gave him mine when I saw the riders from the ridge. I was done with her by then, and he liked to take his turn while they were still warm. I had to pull him off her and shove my clothes into his hand, calfskin boots and velvet doublet, silver chased sword belt, even my sable cloak. 'Ride for the Dreadfort,' I told him. 'Bring all the help you can. Take my horse, he's swifter. And here, wear the ring my father gave me, so they'll know you came from me.' He learned better than to question me. By the time they put the arrow through his back, I'd smeared myself with the girl's filth and dressed in his rags. They might have hanged me anyway, but it was the only chance I saw."
He rubbed the back of his hand across his mouth.
"And now, my sweet prince, there was a woman promised me if I brought 200 men. Well, I brought 3 times as many, and no green boys nor field hands neither, but my father's own garrison."
Theon had given his word. This was not a time to flinch. "Pay him his pound of flesh and deal with him later."
"Harag," he said, "go to the kennels and bring Perla back for Ramsay."
There was a smile on his plump lips, but none in those pale, pale eyes.
"Snow, my wife called me, before she ate her fingers, but I say
Bolton!
His smile curdled.
So, you'd offer me a kennel girl for my good service. Is that the way of it?
There was a tone in his voice Theon did not like, no more than he liked the insolent way the Dreadfort men were looking at him.
She was what was promised.
She smells of dog shit. I've had enough of bad smells, as it happens. I think I'll have your bed warmer instead. What do you call her? Kyra?
Are you mad? Theon said angry. I'll have you...
The bastard's backhand caught him square, and his cheekbone shattered with a sickening crunch beneath the lobster steel. The world vanished in a red roar of pain. Sometime later, Theon found himself on the ground. He rolled onto his stomach and swallowed a mouthful of blood.
"Close the gates!"
he tried to shout, but it was too late. The Dreadfort men had cut down Red Wolf and Kennet, and more were pouring through, a river of mail and sharp swords. There was a ringing in his ears and horror all around him. Black Lauren had his sword out, but there were already four of them pressing in on him. He saw Ulf go down with a crossbow bolt through the belly as he ran for the great hall. Maester Lewin was trying to reach him when a knight on a warhorse planted a spear between his shoulders, then swung back to ride over him. Another man whipped a torch round and round his head and then lofted it toward the thatch roof of the stables.
"Save me the frays!"
the bastard was shouting as the flames roared upward.
"And burn the rest! Burn it all!"
The last thing Theon Greyjoy saw was Smiler, kicking free of the burning stables, with his mane ablaze, screaming, rearing.
Tyrion, Sir Kevin Lannister said wearily, if you are indeed innocent of Joffrey's death, you should have no difficulty proving it at trial. Tyrion turned from the window. Who is to judge me? Justice belongs to the throne. The king is dead, but your father remains Hand. Since it is his own son who stands accused, and his grandson who was the victim, he has asked Lord Tyrell and Prince Oberon to sit in judgment with him. Tyrion was scarcely reassured. Mace Tyrell had been Joffrey's good father, however briefly, and the Red Viper was, well, a snake. Will I be allowed to demand trial by battle? I would not advise that. Why not? It had saved him in the Vale. Why not here? Answer me, uncle, will I be allowed a trial by battle, and a champion to prove my innocence? Certainly, if that is your wish. However, you had best know that your sister means to name Sir Gregor Clegane as her champion in the event of such a trial. The bitch checks my moves before I make them. A pity she didn't choose a kettle black. Bronn would make short work of any of the three brothers, but the mountain that rides was a kettle of a different colour. I shall need to sleep on this. I need to speak with Bronn, and soon. He didn't want to think about what this was like to cost him. Bronn had a lofty notion of what his skin was worth. Does Cersei have witnesses against me?
More every day.
Then I must have witnesses of my own. Tell me who you would have, and Sir Adam will send the watch to bring them to trial. I would sooner find them myself. You stand accused of regicide and kinslaying. Do you truly imagine that you will be allowed to come and go as you please? Sir Kevin waved at the table. You have quill, ink, and parchment. Write the names of such witnesses as you require, and I shall do all in my power to produce them. You have my word as a Lannister. But you shall not leave this tower except to go to trial. Tyrion would not demean himself by begging. Will you permit my squire to come and go, the boy Podrick Payne? Certainly, if that is your wish, I shall send him to you. Do so,
sooner would be better than later, and now would be better than sooner. He waddled to the writing table, but when he heard the door open, he turned back and said, "Uncle?" Sir Kevin paused. "Yes?" "I did not do this." "I wish I could believe that, Tyrion." When the door closed, Tyrion Lannister pulled himself up into the chair, sharpened a quill, and pulled a blank parchment. "Who will speak for me?" He dipped his quill in the inkpot. The sheet was still maiden when Podrick Payne appeared, some time later. "My lord," the boy said. Tyrion put down the quill. "Find Bronn and bring him at once. Tell him there's gold in it, more gold than he's ever dreamed of. And see that you don't return without him." "Yes, my lord. I won't return." He went. He had not returned by sunset, nor by moonrise. Tyrion fell asleep in the window seat to wake stiff and sore at dawn. A serving man brought porridge and apples to break his fast, with a horn of ale. He ate at the table the blank parchment before him. An hour later, the serving man returned for the bowl. "Have you seen my squire?" Tyrion asked him. The man shook his head. Sighing, he turned back to the table and dipped his quill again. "Sansa," he wrote upon the parchment. He sat staring at the name, his teeth clenched so hard they hurt. Assuming Joffrey had not simply choked to death on a bit of food, which even Tyrion found hard to swallow, Sansa must have poisoned him. Joff practically put his cup down in her lap, and he'd given her ample reason. Any doubts Tyrion might have had vanished when his wife did. One flesh, one heart, one soul. His mouth twisted. She wasted no time proving how much those vows meant to her, did she? Well, what did you expect, dwarf? And yet, where would Sansa have gotten poison? He could not believe the girl had acted alone in this. Do I really want to find her? Would the judges believe that Tyrion's child bride had poisoned a king without her husband's knowledge? I wouldn't. Cersei would insist that they had done the deed together. Even so, he gave the parchment to his uncle the next day. Sir Kevin frowned at it. Lady Sansa is your only witness? I will think of others in time. Best think of them now. The judges mean to begin the trial 3 days hence. That's too soon. You have me shut up here, under guard. How am I to find witnesses to my innocence? Your sisters had no difficulty finding witnesses to your guilt. Sir Kevin rolled up the parchment. Sir Adam has men hunting for your wife. Varys has offered 100 stags for word of her whereabouts, and 100 dragons for the girl herself. If the girl can be found, she will be found, and I shall bring her to you. I see no harm in husband and wife sharing the same cell and giving comfort to one another. You are too kind. Have you seen my squire? I sent him to you yesterday. Did he not come? He came, Tyrion admitted, and then he went. I shall send him to you again. But it was the next morning before Podrick Payne returned. He stepped inside the room hesitantly, with fear written all over his face. Bronn came in behind him. The sellsword knight wore a jerkin studded with silver and a heavy riding cloak, with a pair of fine-tooled leather gloves thrust through his sword belt. One look at Bronn's face gave Tyrion a queasy feeling in the pit of his stomach. "It took you long enough." "The boy begged, or I wouldn't have come at all. I am expected at Castle Stokeworth for supper." "Stokeworth?" Tyrion hopped from the bed. "And pray, what is there for you in Stokeworth?" "A bride." Bronn smiled like a wolf contemplating a lost lamb. "I'm to wed Lollies the day after next." "Lollies?" "Perfect, bloody perfect." Lady Tanda's Lackwit daughter gets a knightly husband and a father of sorts for the bastard in her belly, and Sir Bron of the Blackwater climbs another rung. It had Cersei's stinking fingers all over it.
"My bitch sister has sold you a lame horse. The girl's dim-witted.
If I wanted wits, I'd marry you. Lully's is big, with another man's child. And when she pops him out, I'll get her big with mine."
"She's not even heir to Stokeworth," Tyrion pointed out. "She has an elder sister, Felissa, a married sister."
"Married 10 years, and still barren," said Bronn. "Her lord husband shuns her bed. It's said he prefers virgins.
He could prefer goats, and it wouldn't matter. The lands will still pass to his wife when Lady Tanda dies. Unless Felissa should die before her mother."
Tyrion wondered whether Cersei had any notion of the sort of serpent she'd given Lady Tanda to suckle. And if she does, would she care?
"Why are you here, then?"
Bronn shrugged.
"You once told me that if anyone ever asked me to sell you out, you'd double the price."
"Yes."
"Is it two wives you want, or two castles?"
"One of each would serve. But if you want me to kill Gregor Clegane for you, it had best be a damn big castle."
The Seven Kingdoms were full of high-born maidens, but even the oldest, poorest, and ugliest spinster in the realm would balk at wedding such low-born scum as Bronn.
"Unless she was soft of body and soft of head, with a fatherless child in her belly, from having been raped 50 times.
Lady Tanda had been so desperate to find a husband for Lollies that she had even pursued Tyrion for a time, and that had been before half of King's Landing enjoyed her. No doubt Cersei had sweetened the offer somehow, and Bronn was a knight now, which made him a suitable match for a younger daughter of a minor house.
"I find myself woefully short of both castles and high-born maidens at the moment," Tyrion admitted, "but I can offer you gold and gratitude as before."
"I have gold. What can I buy with gratitude?"
"Oh, you might be surprised. A Lannister pays his debts."
"Your sister's a Lannister too.
My lady wife is heir to Winterfell. Should I emerge from this with my head still on my shoulders, I may one day rule the North in her name. I could carve you out a big piece of it."
"If and when, and might be," said Bronn. "And it's bloody cold up there. Lollies is soft, warm, and close. I could be poking her 2 nights hence."
"Not a prospect I would relish."
"Is that so?" Bronn grinned. "Admitted imp, given a choice between fucking Lollies and fighting the mountain, you'd have your britches down and cock up before a man could blink."
"He knows me too bloody well."
Tyrion tried a different tack. "I'd heard that Sir Gregor was wounded on the Red Fork and again at Duskendale. The wounds are bound to slow him."
Bronn looked annoyed.
"He was never fast. Only freakish big and freakish strong. I'll grant you he's quicker than you'd expect for a man that size. He has a monstrous long reach, and doesn't seem to feel blows the way a normal man would."
"Does he frighten you so much?"
asked Tyrion, hoping to provoke him. "If he didn't frighten me, I'd be a bloody fool."
Bronn gave a shrug.
"Might be I could take him, dance around him until he was so tired of hacking at me that he couldn't lift his sword. Get him off his feet somehow. When they're flat on their backs, it don't matter how tall they are. Even so, it's chancy. One misstep, and I'm dead. Why should I risk it? I like you well enough, ugly little horsen that you are. But if I fight your battle, I lose either way. Either the mountain spills my guts, or I kill him and lose Stokeworth. I sell my sword. I don't give it away. I'm not your bloody brother.
No, said Tyrion sadly, you're not. He waved a hand.
Be gone, then. Run to Stokeworth.